Under top stories this hour, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is back from his visit to Oman. Raisi says his visit opened a new chapter in the two countries' relations. Israel defies the international outcry over the recent killing of a Palestinian journalist, saying there is no suspicion of criminal activity in the case. Also, the U.S. Defense Secretary says some 20 countries have announced new security assistance packages for Kiev to help Ukraine in its war with Russia. Thank you for joining us. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has returned home from his groundbreaking visit to Oman. Raisi says the visit opened a new chapter in the two countries' relations.
We don't have much economic relations, and over the past couple of months, our business relations has doubled and stands at over $1 billion. But we believe that there's a lot of potential in order to develop these relations further. And as far as business relations are concerned, both countries and high-ranking officials of the two countries have assigned MOUs in order to develop business and economic relations. In short, 13 MOUs and agreements were signed by the high-ranking officials of Iran and Oman, and this is considered a new page and a new chapter in our relations. Of course, we did have agreements that were signed before, but what really matters is for these agreements to be implemented. And, of course, one issue that was brought up is that these MOUs are not implemented. So this trip is considered a beginning of a new era in order to start implementing these MOUs. The basic pillar of these agreements are mostly regarding fiscal cooperation and also health tourism. Another issue that is important is that the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman can help strong regional relations, and good relations between the two countries can increase cooperation in the region, which was discussed in this meeting and all of the meetings that we had with high-ranking Omani officials. And we are pursuing stronger relations both with Oman and in the region.
Earlier, we were joined by the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf region.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to mm-hmm. region and beyond. And so therefore it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
At least 10 people have died after sections of an unfinished building collapsed in southwestern Iran. Some 29 people have so far been pulled out of the rubble and hospitalized. The 10-story structure came down at around midday in downtown Abadan. Search and rescue operations are underway. There are fears that a number of casualties would rise, with reports saying that up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road, with surrounding buildings evacuated. An investigation is underway to determine the cause of the collapse. The building owner and contractor have already been detained. Defying the international outcry over the recent killing of a Palestinian journalist, Israel says there is no immediate suspicion of criminal activity in the case. The regime's military advocate says even if an Israeli soldier had fatally shot Shirin Abu Akleh, the soldier cannot be held guilty of criminal misconduct. The advocate says the death of the journalist in the midst of an active combat zone does not warrant a criminal investigation. The regime's military advocate is responsible for determining whether any soldier would face disciplinary action for the incident. On May the 11th, Abu Akleh was shot and killed while covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank flashpoint city of Jenin. Her death drew strong international condemnation for the Tel Aviv regime. Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, for which Abu Akleh was reporting, has accused Israel of killing her, quote-unquote, deliberately and, quote-unquote, in cold blood. Hamas has held a national conference in the Gaza Strip to mark the victory of the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance factions against Israel during the 11-day war in May 2021. Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following report.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniya, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The U.S. Defense Secretary says some 20 countries have announced new military assistance packages to help Ukraine in its war with Russia. Lloyd Austin says many countries are donating artillery ammunition, coastal defense systems, and armored vehicles, including tanks, to Ukraine. Others, he said, have committed to training Ukraine's forces and maintaining its military systems. He made the announcement following a virtual meeting of the so-called Ukraine Defense Contact Group. Austin said the countries that announced new packages for Ukraine included Italy, Denmark, Greece, Norway, and Poland. The U.S. and the EU have provided Ukraine with $5.5 billion in military support since Russia launched the war against its neighbor in late February. Russia has warned the U.S. and its allies over their military support for Ukraine, saying the move prolongs the conflict. It has already targeted several Western arms shipments in Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he is willing to meet his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to discuss how to end the war. Addressing the World Economic Forum in Davos by video link, Zelensky said Putin is the only Russian official he'd accept to meet, but only to discuss, quote, stopping the war. The Ukrainian president, however, said arranging talks with Russia was becoming increasingly difficult. He said the reason was evidence of what he called Russian violence against civilians. Moscow has vehemently denied targeting civilians in Ukraine. Russia's lead negotiator said on Sunday that Moscow was prepared to resume peace talks with Kiev. He added that it was Ukraine's initiative to halt the negotiations in the first place. Our correspondent in eastern Ukraine, Johnny Miller, reports from the Donbass region to find people who no longer wish to be a part of Ukraine. Here's more.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartments 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, statues like this that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture, and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Despite EU efforts to boycott Russian energy, Italy has increased its imports of crude oil from Moscow to feed its refineries. As a result, Rome is said to become the EU's largest importer of Russian crude.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy.
Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area.
Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a report, the Israeli regime used weapons made and funded by the United States to destroy projects and businesses in the Gaza Strip during its devastating 11-day war on the besieged enclave last year. We present you an article written by Daniel Bogoslov. The piece is titled, Israel Used U.S. Weapons to Destroy Assets and Aid Projects in Gaza. The article has appeared on the front page of the Intercept website. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles and shells, murdering over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. Despite Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants from Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups, more than half of the martyred were civilians. At the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were damaged. Documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians, weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy humanitarian projects and businesses in Gaza. The destruction reached multiple hospitals, water treatment facilities, and dozens of schools operated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Raad Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, told The Intercept, "The vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States." Raad Jarar added, "It's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the United States one way or another, by U.S. tax dollars. Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade-and-a-half-long Israeli blockade, the Gaza Strip relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes." According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority and human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May of 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States targeted an UNRWA school, martyring 10 civilians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from the Obama administration, whose press secretary decried it as totally indefensible. Michael Link, the recently departed United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of humanitarian rights in the Palestinian territories, said, "A major reason for the perpetuation of Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it is the extraordinary military, diplomatic, and political support given to it, largely without conditions, by the United States." Michael Link added, "This American military assistance is provided, notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports claim that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations." While Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy United Nations-funded projects, or damage the property of civilians in the Gaza Strip. Since 1948, the United States has provided the Israeli regime with over $150 billion worth in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a Memorandum of Understanding that President Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for its Iron Dome missile defense system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows Israel to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other country, that allows the Israeli regime to spend US tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied Palestinian territories, available for use by the Israeli forces, despite Israel's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, Israel tapped into the US stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the United States. As bombs fell on the Gaza Strip last May, the smell of roasting nuts and sizzling potatoes was replaced with the overwhelming stench of burnt plastic. A potato chip factory and a Matouk ice cream factory, which once produced snacks in the hope of instilling a glimmer of joy in the blockaded strip, were completely destroyed in the bombing. Many of the companies established in Gaza's industrial zone did so under the pretext that the Israeli military would not bomb the commercial site. Financed by US aid and fired on by US-funded weapons, the area was thought to be protected under the auspices of the Oslo Accords, which created a special economic zone intended to supplant conflict with mutually beneficial free trade. Also impacted were the Foamco mattress factory, the main producer of mattresses for Gaza, the Abu Iskandar plastic factory, the Clever detergent factory, the Siksik plastic pipes factory, and the Al-Wadi food plant, resulting in tens of millions of dollars worth of damage. The factories employed 1,500 Palestinians and were severely impacted by the shelling in the early morning hours on 17th and 18th of May 2021. The Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which received a $900,000 grant from UNAID to build a surgery center, was also damaged in the Israeli bombing campaign, as was Beit Hanun Hospital, another recipient of UNAID funding. While mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated with US support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli regime's forces' use of American weaponry is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed a number of US laws violated by Israel's attacks on Gaza. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. Also, the Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense. And the Leahy Laws, named after outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights. In May of 2021, as last year's bombing campaign drew to a close, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and several progressive members of the House of Representatives introduced resolutions to block a $735 million weapons package that included the same type of precision-guided bombs that the Israeli regime was already using to shell Gaza. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time, "I believe that the United States must help lead the way to a peaceful and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians. We need to take a hard look at whether the sale of these weapons is actually helping do that or whether it is simply fueling conflict." But the White House demurred. Then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki claimed, "We have seen reports of a move towards a potential ceasefire that is clearly encouraging." The Biden administration approved the sale. This May, Israel launched another bombing campaign on the Gaza Strip.
food for thought.
Salam. And here is the state of the world prophesied by Imam Ali, peace upon him, in the end days, when the Prophet's last and 12th successor reappears to fill the world with justice. When the advent of our Qa'im, the executor, will fall, the heavens will cause its drops to descend, the lands will grow its plants, the malice will disappear from the hearts of the servants, and animals and beasts will be harmless in such a way that a woman will walk from Iraq to Syria, putting the baskets on the head and treading only on green lands, without fearing or being troubled by a beast.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the concept of dignity when it comes to human rights. And we mentioned in a previous episode that dignity is a God-given right to a human being. In fact, it is the essence of every human being to have his dignity. Now, everyone obviously can conclude, obviously everyone with a sane mind can conclude that there is a necessity to have a government. And people, they must have a ruler, be it a good ruler or a bad ruler, as we say, darran aw fajr. And in fact, that's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, and he said, people must have a leader, regardless whether he's good or bad. But a leader must be in place because people, obviously, can only function when there is leadership and government. And no one could dispute this fact. Now, obviously, the discussion and the debate fell whether what type of government should we have? What type of ruler should we have? So, obviously, this concept we discuss. But when it comes to the essence of it, that we need a government, that we need a ruler, it is something that we do not disagree on. Now, when it comes to the people, and at least those who try to look after the rights of people, and if I can put specifically, let's say, the scholars of, let's say, if I can, you know, juggle these terms, the scholars of politics, because I don't want to call them politicians, because the definition of politicians today, it's very different than what it should be. when I say scholars of politics, because politics itself, it is a form of science, or at least a study, that requires those who have knowledge to deal with it, or to discuss it, or to bring it to people. Not anyone who becomes, or at least joins the parliament, or becomes part of the government, we can call him or give him the title politician, even though they do get it anyway, but sadly. So when we look at these people, these scholars of politics, they try to study with the human being himself. Does he have the right to decide his own fate, which is obviously, like we said, it's part of himself, part of his dignity. As a human being who lives in this world, who lives under a specific system or a specific government, do I and you have the right to decide our own fate? Or is it decided for us? And is this right given to us, or is it taken from something else? Like, is it part of us that it needs to be given to us? Or no, this only applies to me when the time is right, or when certain things are into place. So do we have this kind of right to decide our own fate? Now, when we look at the answer to this question, and if we want to look at it from either the natural aspects of life, just a human being by himself, without being governed by anything, or with a system, or under religion or a faith, it takes a different answer. So before we dive into the answer, let us take a break, and then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, when we look at the answer to the question that we asked, is it, do we have the right to decide our fate? Or should the government decide it for us? Is it my natural given right? Or is it given to me when the circumstances are correct or right? Now, obviously, stemming from the Quran and from the Ahlul Bayt and from the Islamic teachings, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created mankind free. And if they are not free, then they need to fight for their freedom. If I and you are not free, if we cannot decide our own fate, then everything falls apart and everything has no meaning no more, especially when it comes to human rights. Now, the difference between a free person and a slave is that a free person can decide his fate and can decide his destiny, where a slave can't. He's stuck. He's under chains. He's owned by someone else. Now, sometimes these chains and this slavery takes different forms. When I and you are put in a government that we call a dictatorship, where people cannot do anything, then they have no right to decide their own fate or make their own destiny. It's made by them or to them by those who rule them. Now, is this correct? Well, obviously not. That goes against the norm. That goes against the nature of mankind. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants a person to create his own fate, because in the hereafter he will be judged upon that, his free choice to make his own free destination or his fate. So when you look at these governments, when you look at these states, they need to give people the right to make their own destination and their own fate. So when politicians, or at least the scholars of politics, as I call them, when they want to look at these laws, they have to make sure that these laws, when they talk about human rights, they have to make sure that the human being or the person, or let's even say the citizen, has the right to make his own choices and his own free decisions and free destination and free fate, if we can say that. And we see that when you look at revolutions throughout history and throughout the world, we see that the main reason why people revolt is the fact that they want to be free to make their own fate and their own destiny, not made by someone else. So now we go back to the topic of dignity. A human being is only dignified when he's free. He's only dignified when he has the right to make his choices. He's only dignified when he feels he is living a life of a free person. When he's not, then obviously all these things fall apart. Now, inshallah, we will continue this discussion in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's woodblocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of thick sheets of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. The ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy. Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in Southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to to over 200 individuals in Iran. Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding. The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north. This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction. In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from the hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tries to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rock hopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryant said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As outlined in the Queen's speech, conservatives are set to bring forward legislation to ban public bodies from participating in BDS campaigns. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kamel Hawash, chair of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, in an article published under the heading Zionist Regime. Anti-boycott bill threatens British democracy. Here's the story. The recent announcement in the Queen's speech on the government's plan to ban public bodies from participating in boycott campaigns, under the pretext that such activity would undermine community cohesion, has been on the cards since the 2019 election campaign, when the Conservatives pledged to do exactly that. This policy is driven by a desire to protect the Zionist regime from the peaceful Palestinian boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS campaign. Despite claiming that BDS is largely ineffective, the fabricated regime of Israel is spending millions of dollars on efforts to combat the movement. Its past actions have included banning foreign boycott activists from entering the occupied territories and pushing U.S. states to adopt anti-boycott laws that punish firms for practicing BDS.